Thank you very much. That was a wonderful introduction by the man himself, John Burks Dizzy Gillespie, with a classic Tintindeo, which he co-wrote with Master Conguero, Chano Pozo. He also did with Chano Pozo Manteca in the early days of fusion music, Afro-Cuban jazz, or as Gillespie was known to call it, Cubop. We celebrate Dizzy Gillespie's birthday today. He would have been 96, born October the 21st, 1917. However, he died at the age of 75 on January the 6th, 1993. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, October the 21st, 7 weeks before the December 13th deadline, by which the House and Senate budget committees should have worked out a conference agreement on the spending and tax levels for the fiscal year 2014. The temporarily averted crisis over the debt ceiling, government shutdown, and Obamacare still has Washington mired in the partisan politics of blame. But with the budget deadline looming, the battle lines will be drawn up and around deep cuts in the federal budget. Our guest says that the biggest fiscal policy crisis confronting the Obama administration has gone unaddressed for 5 years. He is Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Teaches About Globalization, and has published numerous articles in both academic and popular venues, including USA Today, The Guardian, The American Prospect, Challenge Magazine, and Worth. Thank you, Josh Bivens, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. What is this? Why would you call it the greatest crisis yet unaddressed?
Because I think it's not well appreciated just how historically severe the austerity measures of the past 3 years have been. If you compare what we have done to public spending, sort of all levels of government, federal, state, and local, since the official end of the Great Recession, which was about the middle of 2009, and you compare that to the recovery from every other recession we have had since World War II, we are a historical outlier in how slowly public spending has grown. It's been pretty much flat for a long time, whereas in most other points in the business cycle, we should have seen public spending by about 15% higher than it is today if we just followed the historical average. And that degree of austerity essentially explains entirely why recovery from the Great Recession has been so agonizingly slow. I mean, we're more than 5 years since it began. We still have 7.3% unemployment. We have 5 million workers who don't have jobs but are not counted as officially unemployed because they've just dropped out of the labor force because job opportunities are so scarce. So we are strangling the recovery with austerity, and yet nobody is really talking about reversing that.
Well, this is very interesting that you would say it's historic. And in fact, I read in one of your articles, you called it unprecedented. This is a word that has been hounding the administration in many, many ways, the word unprecedented. Now, one would not associate unprecedented austerity with a so-called liberal administration. So what is it about the Obama administration that has basically been able to conduct one of the most austere domestic policies and still not be seen as historically unprecedented austerity?
I think a couple things. I mean, I think one is sort of the first thing the Obama administration did when they came into office was pass the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or the Recovery Act, as most people call it. And this was a hugely useful piece of legislation for my mind. And it did actually temporarily for about the first year and a half of their term in office increase federal spending. It was not enough to push back against the enormous shock to private spending that the burst housing bubble accounted for, but it really was an effort to ramp up public spending to fight the recession. And I think a lot of people, that's still the signature thing they did in the minds of a lot of people. They increased federal spending. But by the end of 2010, and then especially in the middle of 2011, when we had our last sort of debt ceiling showdown with the House Republicans demanding concessions in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, we have just steadily ratcheted down federal spending at the same time as state and local governments have ratcheted down their spending too. And so that impression, the first impression of the Obama administration doing lots of spending to fight the recession, that's correct, but that is long since an obsolete impression. And then I think that's also combined with the fact that you had deficits rise really rapidly at the beginning of the Obama administration, which people take as a sign of overspending. It's in fact a sign of a weak economy and weak tax collection. And those deficits have come down a lot in the past 3 years, but somehow people have not noticed that.
Now, you referred to the Stimulus Act, formerly known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, and under the terms of that act, the Obama administration essentially had $787 billion to do some to provide some stimulus to the economy, and it went from 787 to $831 billion between 2009 and now, at least. What has happened to that money? Where did it go? Has it been spent, all of it?
Essentially, all of it has been spent. There may be a little bit of it still trickling out, but not enough to do much at all to move the economy. About a third of it was tax cuts, and they have all been spent, and they were spent within the first year and a half of the passage of the act. A good part of it was extensions to unemployment insurance and food stamps. A lot of the unemployment insurance extensions have since faded away. They're no longer operative. The extension to food stamps is still with us, which is why food stamps is one of the very few public programs that actually have not seen funding just collapse. There's been a lot of efforts to sort of hack away at the extensions in Congress, but they're set to expire, those extensions in the Recovery Act for food stamps in 2014. And then you had some direct spending projects, you know, government building bridges, roads, paying for things like that. Those have pretty much run out by now. Those were the things that lasted the longest. They're the hardest to get off the ground because they require the most administrative complexity. But even those have pretty much wound their way through to the economy, and the spending for those has pretty much dried up. So a lot of money was spent. It lasted about two and a half years of having a real impact on the economy, but that means it has long since stopped boosting the economy.
The Obama administration gave a very generous hand to several business sectors, most notably Wall Street, the automobile manufacturers, and so forth. Did that yield the proper returns on the investment made there?
I think they can be separated. So I would say on the sort of finance and Wall Street, a lot of the money that eventually went to Wall Street firms was actually allocated before the Obama administration came into office, and that money, they didn't cancel it. That money still went out largely. You know, did it have the proper response? My sense is that it did what it was meant to do. That is, it sort of forestalled a full-scale financial crisis. I think you could have done the same thing while being much less generous to the incumbent managers of Wall Street firms. I don't think we got near enough out of it in terms of, you know, better regulation of Wall Street and more firings and prosecutions of people who did unsavory things during the crisis. So I don't think it was – I think it was – too much money spent for without enough in the way of a quid pro quo, but I think it largely did stabilize the financial system. I think the auto sector loans paid off very well. I mean, I think if there had been an uncontrolled bankruptcy of some of the big auto firms, we would have had a much, much deeper recession than we had otherwise. And if you look at some very auto-dependent states like Ohio, you see states actually doing better than the national average in terms of labor market outcomes, which is a real change from the past decade or so.
On a political level, maybe this is part of what one of the reasons that we don't associate the Obama administration with the word austerity, and that is coming in, you know, as first African American president and with very liberal credentials in some parts of the U.S. That those were two things that got people very uncomfortable. And was it that the Obama administration did not want essentially to be seen as the, you know, the old tax and spend, you know, the stereotypical tax and spend, despite the fact that almost all economic quarters were saying that this is the time, precisely the time, to spend money, especially in shoring up those things that are the foundations of an economy, meaning employment, jobs of all kinds, to the extent that you can, and to get the economy going, to cut the unemployment rate, which is the number one thing. The constituencies that supported him on the basis of jobs, which was a number one priority. Was there a political reluctance to essentially spend in that sense? I know the Economic Policy Institute had been advocating spending, especially on social programs, precisely at this time, rather than for political reasons holding to this notion, which the Clinton administration had, to follow that pattern of saying, well, we're Democrats, but we're a different kind of Democrats. We are Democrats with Republican sensibilities, and we're watching the treasure chest, we being very austere.
I think that's absolutely true in regards that, like, policymaking people in the Democratic Party over the past couple of decades have become far too scared of budget deficits and the risks associated with budget deficits, and far too complacent about the need to use bigger budget deficits to fight recessions. I think there was always this thought, if a recession comes, that can mostly be handled by the Federal Reserve, and big deficits are really, really dangerous. Big temporary deficits are actually not that dangerous, especially when they're driven by economic downturns. And the Federal Reserve doesn't have as much power to fight recessions as people think. And so I think those bits of conventional wisdom coming into this crisis were shared by a lot of the Obama administration. I will say, if you look at the first, you know, 2 years of the Obama administration, they passed the Recovery Act. I think they had a lot of faith, excess faith, that if this isn't enough, if this doesn't do the job, surely Congress will see Americans are suffering and will provide a little more support to the economy. But then we have the midterm elections in November 2010, and he's got an incredibly intransigent House GOP, GOP-controlled House, that really is the driver of the austerity we've seen since. My guess is the Obama administration would have liked to have seen more spending over this time to support the recovery, but the GOP-controlled House of Representatives is just a brutal roadblock to actually making that get done.
Well, when you talk about spending, you're talking about a budget. Have we seen one in 5 years?
Do you happen to know, you're an economist, where it went? The first year, actually, where we passed one out of the House and Senate, and then we never had a final one that ironed out the differences. But yes, we have not had a budget for a long time, which I think is largely, again, a function of the House GOP. I mean, basically, we don't have a budget because the House and Senate cannot agree on one. And one reason they can't agree on one is because the House GOP is 100% intransigent on never seeing a penny of taxes raised to close budget deficits.
As putting on your, or keeping on your economist hat, what would have been the most prudent thing to do, or even to do now? Let's say he didn't get it done in the first term. What should the president be thinking of doing? Is austerity still the number one issue of cutting the deficit?
I think at this point, I think we should try to reverse as much austerity as we can as just a pure economics exercise. You know, I think we could do, frankly, another Recovery Act and still not quite get back to a fully healed economy. That is obviously not on the table. The administration and the Senate budget that was passed takes a small step in that direction, and it would repeal the sequester cuts for 2014, which would basically allow about an extra $90 billion in spending to get into the economy, which would support, you know, about 900,000 jobs in the next year if that actually happened. We probably need about 8 million jobs to get back to a fully healthy economy, so it's a small step, but it's a step in the right direction. You know, even that is going to be very, very hard to pull off. So I think they probably have some of the same preferences I would in terms of at least the direction of fiscal policy, if not the magnitude of how much stimulus we need instead of austerity. And yet they still have the huge roadblock in front of them of a GOP House that it's really hard to see how any increase in spending actually gets through.
Does the negative feedback post the last major blow up around the Republican Party, does that in any way give some degree of instruction to them that they need to understand that there's a different way to go? The public opinion is not on their side at the moment.
It's a good question. I feel like for the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, there's been this thought that eventually, you know, especially once the election of 2012 passed, you know, you could say it made some strategic sense for the House GOP to kind of obstruct measures that would actually make the economy better because it would bear fruit in the election for them, and it didn't. And so maybe that was supposed to break their fever. And then this latest showdown where they became extraordinarily unpopular was also supposed to provide an incentive for them to be more of a sort of good faith negotiating partner and trying to do something to help the economy. It hasn't happened yet. And so it's unclear to me what is going to be the tipping point. Maybe this is finally it. Maybe in the next month there's a very productive budget debate where short-term spending is increased and things on the sort of long-term view, including tax increases, are done to reduce long-term deficits, which if we have a deficit problem at all, it's in the long term. It is not in the short term. But I guess I'll believe it when I see it. If everything that has happened so far hasn't convinced them to sort of change their ways, I don't know what will.
Well, in any event, there are some programs. When people talk about austerity, there are some social programs that are in the crosshairs. Do you expect that there would be movement, even by a liberal, so-called liberal administration of Barack Obama, on the issues, let's say, of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the like?
That is the big fear. So clearly, liberals generally truly really dislike the sequester and don't want those cuts to happen in the next year. But Republicans, especially in the House, tend to be, you know, rock solid on we will not let a penny of taxes get increased. And so if you're going to undo the sequester and you're not going to raise taxes, that means to make it budget neutral, you have to do something somewhere else on the spending side, and that's where these mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare come into play. And so I think that's the real fear. In order to undo some of the sequester in the short term, they will take some long-term cuts in these social insurance programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I think that would be terrible. I think that'd be a truly bad outcome. That as much as I hate the sequester and want support for employment in the short run, discretionary spending gets legislated every single year. We have to have a budget every year, whereas changes to the social insurance programs, those are permanent until Congress changes them. And so the idea that we should do something in the short run and change Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid forever in exchange for doing something in the short run that can be, you know, reversed in 2015 or 2016, that just seems like a terrible idea to me. Those social insurance programs are so important, and to cut them in a way that will be locked in forever unless we can change it, that seems like a disastrous outcome.
Well, I wondered whether you had some thoughts about it. Does, you know, I've been looking at this administration, and one of the things that I find really hard to find is policy. What is the policy? You know, every administration, you would think, has a policy about something, and the policy drives the budget allocations. It drives the amount of money being spent on a particular thing. Does this administration have an articulated policy about, let's say, even this situation of austerity? Does it have a policy for the nation?
You know, it's a good question. I would say the natural place to look for their fiscal policy preferences is in the president's budget, which comes out almost every year. And they definitely in their budget have they would their preference is to turn off the sequester for this year, and so that would increase spending a bit. They would pay for it with some tax increases. So I think they do. I think their preferences clearly signal to me they want to go in the correct direction on fiscal policy. They want to stop it strangling the recovery so much. They want to turn off the sequester for the next year or two. To me, it's not enough. I think that the degree of support the economy needs is still one that the administration is definitely not throwing their support behind. I think they would say it's just so politically unrealistic to expect fiscal support on the order of another Recovery Act to come to pass that it would just be silly for them to, you know, adhere allegiance to that. To me, the numbers are the numbers. But so I think in terms of the direction they want fiscal policy to go, to reverse austerity and to be more stimulative, I think they're pretty clearly on record there. I think it's still far below what the economy actually needs to have a fully healthy economy again.
Just before you go, Josh, could you lay out the logic of spending at a time when people are saying that we already have spent too much? What is the logic behind that?
Well, the logic is that we still have an economy that is producing far less than it could potentially produce if all idle resources, labor, capital, factories, if all those were fully employed. In the Congressional Budget Office, for example, calculates potential GDP, which is what we could produce if everybody who wanted a job was able to find a job. And we're basically producing about $1 trillion below what we could produce if everyone was employed. It's called the output gap. That's what that measure is called. And the difference between those two things is just simply a shortfall in demand. The housing bubble burst in 2007, destroyed about $6 trillion in wealth. That made households stopped spending so much. People were financing consumption out of rising home prices. They pulled back their spending. Businesses stopped investing because consumers weren't coming through the door. And so we just have this generalized lack of demand, lack of spending in the private sector because of that enormous burst housing bubble. And that's not going to change on its own. What needs to change is we need some other exogenous shift in spending to come forward, and the only ones who can really do that are the federal government. And it was the logic of the Recovery Act, which everybody kind of agreed on. Yes, clearly this economy needs demand for goods and services to start soaking up unemployed people. Nothing has changed since. We are still far, far under potential. We sort of stopped the free fall with the Recovery Act, but we have not pushed the economy back up to potential. And unless the government does it, there's really no prospect for on their own households or businesses to all of a sudden just decide to start spending more, because there's really no ability for them to spend more. Their incomes are stuck at this sort of suboptimal level.
And at what point in U.S. history do we find an example of just what you are explaining?
The
government was spending money at a time when it allegedly didn't have it to spend.
Yeah, the Great Depression is the clearest one. And so, you know, what we refer to as the Great Depression now is actually sort of a series of recessions and depressions. And so in the early 1930s, as FDR comes into office, we start spending a little more, and we do some pretty radical things to monetary policy. And between 1933 and 1937, the economy grows very rapidly. There's a very rapid decline in unemployment. Recovery is well on its way. And then in 1937, people get nervous about budget deficits. And so they target much lower deficits, and they cut back spending, and the economy slams back into a bad recession, and unemployment goes back up. And then that's not solved completely until the massive spending we need to do to mobilize for World War II. And so there's nothing magical about military spending. It was just spending that got people employed, and I think that's what we should take the lesson.
Josh, thank you so much for this little primer today. It was very informative. And of course, I know you'd be watching this like a hawk, so we'll be talking again soon when you think you have a handle on what the austerity measures this administration is likely to take in the upcoming talks by December the 13th. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. All right. What we'll do now is The way a problem is perceived, you take a look at how people in spheres of influence look at a problem. You and I, we take a look at the problem from an entirely different angle. It's another thing to see the problem from the inside, where these perceptions shape policy and inevitably shape action. We're about to hear an insider give his assessment of the recently averted crisis. His name is Bill McInturff. He is the co-founder of Public Opinion Strategies, a national political and public affairs research firm, and according to the New York Times, the leading Republican polling company. What this particular company does, as it explains itself on its web page, its homepage, is that it really does more than just take public opinion polls. Much of the work, it says, has been devoted to what is known as combat message development, not simply monitoring public opinion, but developing messages to defend and promote client interests on complex public policy issues. That's think tank level thinking, and this particular person, Bill McInturff, and his company are retained by political parties and the healthcare industry and other industries to figure out how should these firms, how should or government or political parties situate themselves in the minds of the public when dealing with a major catastrophe? What does the road look like? What does the landscape look like? And if it's working against them, how could they make it work? I found this presentation that Bill McInturff made just on the 16th, last Friday. And he's talking to a consortium of health care companies and insurance industries. And here is his instruction to them. This is the CEOs and the upper management level of these organizations trying to get an understanding with respect to Obamacare, just how to situate themselves in the field. So here he is giving them his opinion in a fast overview. He's talking to health insurance companies sponsored by America's Health Insurance Plans. And this is how he laid out the strategy. You'll hear a lot about numbers, but you will see how the thinking goes and how very much affected by policy we are, because this is the way these folks appreciate the landscape. Bill McInturff speaking last Friday to a group of health insurance companies sponsored by America's Health Insurance Plans.
I want to just confirm for you, in eighth grade, when they put you in the different sex ed class, they tell you if you give speeches, you either have to do one sports metaphor or some manly Sun Tzu quote. I won't do sports, but I found a manly Sun Tzu quote. He spends two chapters of the book talking about you're needing to find the right terrain for the battle. And so what he basically says is that all the battle success is based on your capacity to fight the battle in your terrain. And then he says if you don't, you lose. And this is the context I want to put in terms of what just happened. And let's just talk about what was fundamentally flawed about what just happened, which is what horrible terrain. Because there's a massive difference between when you ask people, do you favor, oppose, have a positive, negative opinion of Obamacare, versus a different question, which is, do you want to see it totally eliminated and defunded? And when you ask that question, which we did in CNBC, 38% said yes, 44% said no. You can't shut down a government with 38% yes. And then here's the question that should have been asked, which we did, which is of those 38%, we said, okay, but if you believe it should be totally eliminated and defunded, should we have a government shut down until it's removed? 19% of Americans said yes, that they supported a government shutdown to totally eliminate funding for Obamacare. 19%. So that's pretty awful terrain. You're not going to win a public battle where one out of five people believe that what you're doing is makes sense and what they want. And then it got worse. Karen Wood again was kind enough to talk about the impact of our NBC Wall Street Journal poll that was released late last week, because that number changed during the debate. Because as people heard about what was happening, people start shifting their opinions. And their opinion shifted to, do I favor post totally eliminating and defunding Obamacare? 50% said no. Let me talk a little bit about the roots of why it happened. We, in the old days, this is a 20-year chart, and it's telling you from 20 years ago, the most liberal Republican to the most conservative Democrat, and how much overlap there was in the House of Representatives. So in other words, a generation ago, there was 344 members that were positioned between the most liberal Republican and the most conservative Democrat. And then you can see how that changes. And so in the last session, according to the National Journal, there was 11 people who crossed party boundaries. In other words, we have become a functional parliamentary system where the parties have become, both parties, it isn't Republicans, both parties have become much more ideological, and there is no overlap anymore in terms of any kind of shared kind of common ground in Washington. Why? Because of the way we drew the congressional seats. Again, when I started my career after the 1980 campaign in national politics, there were 134 House seats that were different than how they voted for president. In other words, I could be a Democrat member who had voted for Reagan. I could be a Republican member in a seat that they had voted for Carter. And there were 134 of those seats. Today, we're down to 26 seats. That means we have 26 people who wake up in a district where how they voted for president is how they voted different than how they voted for Congress. What does that do? Instantly, what it means is we have about 350 members of 435 who don't worry functionally about losing a general election. They worry about losing a primary. And if you're concerned about losing a primary, your instincts are radically different in terms of your behavior. The other thing that's happened is I was there in the 1995-96 shutdown, but only about 15% of the members of the House and Senate were. We have a stunningly new House and a stunningly new Senate. So again, the job of your association and Karen's job and what you do is so important because there is zero institutional memory. So the stuff that I take for granted having been through, people no longer been through in Congress. And then there's this, which is when people say, well, how can they be so tone deaf? You have to understand they're not tone deaf. Republicans weren't being tone deaf. They're representing their constituents. Because in Republican districts around the country in October, this is the worst data set I've seen for Republicans in a very long time, in their districts, the districts they represent, Barack Obama's approval is 37%, 57% disapprove. And people in their districts last week said, yeah, I want a Republican House 46 to 38. In other words, their 230-plus seats are a bastion of people who agree and think and have very high disapproval ratings for the president. Let me kind of put this in context. My former wife, we have these International Republican and Democrat Institutes. We send people all over the world to kind of do democracy training. She helped write the constitution for Romania 3 weeks after the Ceausescu's were shot. She and her other folks trained all the new candidates to run for office for the first time ever in Romanian history. And then they set up these teams where you go back and help monitor the people you helped elect and kind of help get democracy off the ground. So It works. She goes over there two or three times. They elect a parliamentary system. They have a prime minister. She goes over with a year with the American delegation. They're kind of American delegations here. Romanians are here. And the American delegation says, well, how's it going now that you're actually in office and you're voting in the parliament? And they said, well, it's going pretty well. We only have one question for the American delegation. And they said, oh, well, okay, what is it? Are we supposed to vote for what our constituents want or what we think is right? And the American delegation breaks out laughing and says, okay, well, that'll be chapter 22 in the Federalist Papers when you figure that out. So the point I want to powerfully make that people don't understand is, look, Republicans were, and they wasn't just kind of out of the blue. They're doing what their constituents wanted. Their constituents, though, are just been carved into very special seats that are incredibly Republican. And then I always do this as well. I want you to remind that, guess what, from that story, people have a right to do what they think is right. So I get these calls from the New York Times and NPR and other, you know, MSNBC and these sort of liberal institutions, and they always talk about, and they ask me about, well, how crazy Republicans are. Why would you do this? This is crazy. And what I tend to do is that, for example, the New York Times did this glowing editorial in 2010 after the Democrats lost 63 seats with a list of like the 37 heroes who voted for health care who just lost their seat. And all these heroes who had been quoted saying, look, I believe in universal health care. It's been 75 years. If this costs me my seat, fine. I want to do the right thing. And I said, you editorialized and said these were American heroes. So that was nuts. They lost 63 seats. They voted in a partisan bill that, you know, has no bipartisan support to kind of change a sixth of our economy. So you can't say those people are heroes. And then when you elect a different generation who says, okay, well, I know only 19% of the country agrees with me, and I know no one wants to totally eliminate and defund it, and I know this, but I think it's a terrible bill, and I think it should be stopped, and I don't care. And if I lose my seat, okay, because I'm doing what I think is right. And now, that's not a very good way to legislate, by the way, and it leads to what you've just seen. But people have to understand that these are sincerely held beliefs, and you can't pick one or the other. If it was admirable to vote for a bill you knew would be massively unpopular and cost you your seat, it's no more crazy to then try to stop it and be willing to lose your seat. So what are the consequences of what we've just seen? First, this had an enormous impact on the confidence about the direction of the country. Gallup has been doing this forever, where they ask people, are you satisfied with the way you're being governed? These are the three lowest marks in American history. And again, when you slip below Watergate levels, you know things are bad. So we are at an all-time kind of two- or three-generation record for lack of confidence about how we're being governed in Washington. The most damaging thing is the significant drop in consumer confidence. The debt ceiling fight of 2 years ago was one of the single most significant events that killed consumer confidence since 1952. We're going to have to wait till end of October, but we're watching the same instant kind of drop. Gallup has their own daily tracking where they look at kind of perceived confidence about the economy. We've been underwater for years, and starting in June, if you can see it, we were -3. We'd come to the highest level we'd had for 6 years. And then between September and October, actually almost daily, we dropped 17 points in a month because they were dropping a point a day, day after day after day during the shutdown. You cannot take a fragile economy, remove $24 billion of economic activity, demolish this kind of consumer confidence, and not know that there's going to be an enduring consequence. Number three. It's led to enormous anger about people in Washington and our elected system. We have a very cool question that my Democratic partner, Peter Hart, made up, where we've been asking people, because he said, you know, let's just ask people, if you could, and you could vote out every single member of Congress, including your own representative, would you vote yes to remove every single person in Congress? Now, we don't vote like that, but it was a way just for us pollsters to measure a level of discontent and anger. So the high water mark was October 2010, 45% said yes, and that 45% produced a 63-seat shift. After the debt ceiling negotiation, we popped the question on, it was 54%, last week it was 60%. In other words, 6 out of 10 people said, I would start totally from scratch. And again, that level of anger is debilitating, and it kind of leads to a lack of confidence in our institutions. Now, from a Republican perspective, this was an ideological boomerang. We've been asking people about the role of government, basically want government to do more, government to do less. We spent years where we've had the country at 48-48. I normally use the 48-48 and say, of course we're at paralysis. If you ask a fundamental question about the role of government and you're equally divided in the country, whether it should do more or less, of course we're having a massive public fight. But what this shutdown did was it tipped older women, swing voters and others, and it tipped them slightly the direction of saying, nope, we need government to do more. That's the opposite of what you'd want as a Republican. The second thing that Republicans did was, what has been remarkable about Obamacare is the level of intensity from Republicans has always been extraordinary. There's been no real intensity of support from the Democrats. That their core people who ought to be favoring this bill favor it, you know, kind of without much strength, with kind of weak tea. And then guess what happened? If you shut down the government over this issue, then the hard Democrat partisans say, oh, well, if they're going to be that against it, I'm for it. And so what happened in these intervening 2 weeks, two and a half weeks, is that the Democrat intensity shifted and moved, and that actually the support for the bill is at its high water mark since the 2012 election when it got this close. Okay, so again, Gallup has been recording the Republican Party image for a very long time. The Republicans have the lowest favorable image of any major political party in Gallup history. Again, these charts are difficult to read, but I'm just kind of starting with way over on the left from the early 90s. Both parties are relatively the same, 54%. Impeachment is the other issue that looks like this. The impeachment votes by Republicans against Clinton led to the exact same kind of data. So the Republican Party favorable image drops to 31. Today, Democrats at 43, Republicans at 28%, and that means that the unfavorable rating for Republicans is in the high 60s. That's a huge number. I mean, again, you all work and have, for lots of you have consumer brands. Imagine a consumer brand that had dropped to 28% favorable. And now, by the way, again, people don't talk about it, but the other point of this is the Democrat brand is not in great shape. Both of them have dropped. You can see a little drop in the dark green line, but it's that we're not talking about that because we're talking about the significant drop for Republicans. Okay, the other congressional preference moves against Republicans. The NBC Wall Street Journal doesn't ask how they vote. It just says, do you want a Republican House or a Democrat House? So in September, people wanted a Democrat House by 3 points, and then by October, 2.5 weeks later, by 8 points. Now, here's the probable point. To actually win the House, the Democrats to win the House, they probably need to win the actual vote cast by roughly about 4 to 6%. So 8% is probably not going to stay in place. I don't think this is what it'll look like by next year. But if it were that big in a year, then the House is imperiled. Because given those congressional district lines, it would take a massive Democrat vote to try to replace a Republican House. Okay, so what's coming next? Let me tell you what happens in Washington, which is there's sort of like a trend line, and then Washington presumes and the press presumes that trend line will continue unchanged. That's not how public policy works. It's not how public opinion gets framed. There are no straight lines. In early September, we had a two-week meltdown over Syria. This is a country that changes its focus incredibly quickly. You cannot keep people focused on one topic. My favorite quote, Democracy in America, de Tocqueville, writing about the American character. This is like, 1828, and he spends 2 years here, and he's writing about this whole book about what are Americans like. And you read this book, and you say, wow, they sound a lot like us. And what he said is Americans are the only people in the world who would build a dream house and move before the roof is finished. So my point is, just because you're seeing all this grim data, it doesn't mean it's going to stay this way. We'll get to some other issue very quickly. Things will go back a little bit to normal, and that leads to number two. This is a, you were kind of to mention the 6 million interviews. What I was trying to convey about this data set last week was, okay, that means I've done a lot of surveys. And my friend Peter Hart dates back to the mid-60s. When Peter Hart says, this is one of the five or six most consequential polls I've done in my career in terms of how quickly attitudes have changed, and then he talks about, what has it been like? Oh, the Tet Offensive in 1968, the release of the Nixon tapes in 1973. When Peter starts comparing, like, this is the sixth survey in my career since the mid-60s where we've seen data change this quickly, you've dropped essentially a public opinion bomb that's kind of blown up kind of the normal world where we normally see modest changes. When you do something like that, you don't get to understand it. It takes months to settle down because when you blow everything up, it doesn't reassemble in the same place. It shifts subtly, and that's going to take 3 to 6 months. And so we're not going to really know the enduring consequence of this because everyone has to write, and there'll be Sunday talk shows, who won, who lost. This is nonsense. This is going to take months to figure out what happened and the consequence. Now, but the third thing is, despite every bit of data that you've seen, it doesn't mean that Republicans necessarily have a bad election cycle in 2014. One, as I said, the House has been drawn to have 190 safe seats. You need 218. There are very few seats in play. And also, most of the Senate campaigns are in Republican terrain. So despite everything you're seeing, you can't look at this and say, oh, my gosh, that's like means bad things for Republicans. Because typically in America, when we're sitting around next October, this episode will be in the long rearview mirror and probably will not have that much consequence on what happens. The other thing I wish I could tell you is Mitch McConnell has quoted. I love the quote saying, there's not much learning in the second kick of a mule. And he said the first kick was 95, 96, which he was there. This is the second kick. We didn't learn much. And he promised not to, he said, hopefully my caucus and all these new people learned their lesson. We're not going to do this again. Having said all that, don't expect much change. When I told you and I showed you the reasons why this happened, none of those things changed. It's a real simple kind of equation. If that's Bill's five reasons for why this happened, did any of those five things actually change in the last 3 weeks? No. And if those things haven't changed, I don't think you're going to see much fundamental change in how Congress works or this continued level of paralysis. Now, number five. Here's the other kind of core rule they teach you in politics, which is if your opponent is imploding, please stand back and let them do it without you anywhere close. So here's, of course, the other thing that happened, which is the Obamacare, the sign-up website has had all these, quote, glitches. The sign-ups are going very slowly. I mean, this in any other world, had the government been open and Republicans had stepped back and let their opponents be the center of attention, we'd be talking about, oh, my gosh, this is all not working well. But guess what? That's what we'll drift back to. The shutdown story will go in the rearview mirror, and people will start focusing, okay, well, where are we now? What is the point with Obamacare? How is it working? And it's not going to go well for the Obamacare supporters. And that's where I've also been saying, was we're shifting from a policy debate and a kind of fundamental debate we've had about the role of government for 3 or 4 years to, does this work or not work? And that's my other point. Americans are not really an ideological country. This is a country that realigns based on, does it work or not work? And their attitudes about this law are very simple. They're going to be based on, does it work or not work? So between NBC, Wall Street Journal, and CNBC, where we also do polling, we created a series of tracks in September so that we would have a baseline to measure what's the real impact of this law or perceived impact on people. So one, we asked how likely are you to sign up for an exchange. 14% of everybody 18 to 64 said I'd be likely, at least very or somewhat likely to do it. 32% of the people not insured. I don't see yet. There's no evidence from any polling I've seen that says they're going to get to 7 million people, much less the original estimate of 9. I will be very surprised. It doesn't mean they're not going to do it. There's enormous money out there. There's an infrastructure in place. There's a need. It could happen. You just don't see it in terms of polling yet. The other thing we did in CNBC is we asked people this question. Have your premiums increased? Have your work hours been reduced? Have you lost your job? Have you lost private coverage? Are you being insured for the first time? Then we asked that question. Then we said, and do you think it's because of the new health care law or for some other factor? And I'm showing you the baseline numbers in September among all Americans, saying that 18% of Americans said, yeah, I think my premium's going up because of the law. 3% my hours have been reduced. 3% I've lost coverage. 1% I've been insured for the first time. And what struck me, Stan Greenberg, a Democrat pollster, did some work about Obamacare. And he, I think, tried to, as always, which is fine, try to present the positive stuff for why this is all getting better. But what struck me was when you look at the data and it says, hey, do you think this new health care law is going to be better for you, worse for you, or about the same? And people start off net worse, and then he gives them all the positives, and again, fairly good survey. He gave some of the negatives, and then he repeats the question. And at the end, it's still a net worse. And my point is, this is really simple. The president's core promise has been, and this is why you're so instrumental in this, his core promise has been, if you like your good private coverage, you can keep it. And if that happens, this will be fine. If in fact people start having their good private coverage replaced, and it makes them unhappy, and it does that in large numbers, it doesn't matter. And this is, you know, it doesn't matter what people say now. They're going to be ticked. And if they're going to be ticked, they're going to look and say, what are you going to do to fix this? Because I'm losing my good private coverage. So in my mind, you have always been the core and center of this story that entire hinge. Because here's the last thing you have to remember. The elements of Obamacare that really are popular are all health insurance reform items. They are pre-existing conditions, guarantee of coverage, 26 years old, and the entire language in any survey about what people want are all the things that are health insurance reforms. So if in fact, as I said, they don't work and you lose good coverage and you lose it times millions of people and that's what happens, this whole thing will be very, very destable. So just kind of comparing notes and trying to put this in perspective. I travel a lot. I was in New York. I was reading that little Daily News, that little tabloid. I was flipping through it. There's a little story in the corner. It was set in Queens, New York. There was a judge whose critics thought he was too liberal and he wasn't tough enough on crime. And he got mugged on the way to his car after work. And he came back 2 or 3 days later. He was kind of black and blue. And he said, today is very unusual, but I have an opening statement. He said, I know there's a cynical old joke that a liberal is just a conservative who's not yet been mugged, but I want you to know I have been mugged, and I'm not changing my views. I still believe in social justice. And this little lady stood up in the back of the room and said, beat him up again. He didn't get the message. So that's sort of what we do with polling. We're trying to, you know, and what I will tell you about American public opinion is it works like that little old lady where it keeps beating people up till they get the message. And so that's why at the end of the day I become less cynical cycle after cycle because American public opinion really does in some way referee the worst of our kind of instincts and behavior. So,
well, that's Bill McInturff talking to a group of health insurance companies, and you can sense as well that there's a strong Republican leaning because he's interpreting the debacle from that perspective, the Republicans, and with how they fared and still will fare in the time ahead based on the actions during the shutdown. I hope that was useful. It certainly was mind-boggling to me and very illuminating because when people start talking at that level where they are in a room with folks who set policy, who can make things happen the way they want to happen, these are the kinds of discussions that they have. They're not talking in generalities, they're speaking with numbers, and as you can as you heard, he talked about even the likely impact of the next midterm elections, what would happen there. He talked about the Democrats and how they situated. It's very fascinating stuff. So while we are thinking, you know, we're on the outside, these folks on the inside, they're way ahead of us. And they have the science to back them up. This is the point I make about political science. These things are not left to chance. They think of every possible angle of how to formulate policy, how to decide where the next move should be and how to make that next move. I found it very, very fascinating, and I hope you found it fascinating too. It was very, very important to listen to that because it gives us an entirely different view on this kind of amorphous thing that we've been discussing called Obamacare. I also hope that you benefited from the interview with Josh Bevin from the Economic Policy Institute talking about, you'd never associate austerity with the Obama administration, but in fact, that's the truth. The Obama administration has already begun a program of austerity and is unwilling to basically invest in social programs, especially programs for jobs. That's this the most important jobs, social security and the like. These are the things that are in the crosshairs. And as the budget, hopefully they'll actually produce the first budget of the Obama administration come December the 13th. By then they're supposed to have something of a budget articulated. We will learn how, to what degree, the Obama administration itself is going to carve deeply into these programs. We saw what happened to food stamps, and then you see what the thinking is, the idea that it's what we, you and I, would think would be common sense approaches. There are so many political, ideological thinking, so much of that goes into whether something becomes a policy or not. So thanks for your time today. I hope it was valuable to you. Please do pass the word along and let people know that this is where you come to every day to share your ideas and opinions. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And you can always reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Hutrice Lead. Thanks. See you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.